You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo. Hey, welcome, Reinvest audience. Thank you for joining us today for another episode of the Reinvest Podcast, episode number 55. So at the time of this recording, we're about 3 to 4 months into some rapidly changing economic factors in our real estate market.
People are starting to feel the squeeze. Interest rates for the residential market are in the sevens for probably most loan products, and prices have not really started to drop yet. So I think people are feeling it. I think people are stressed out. People are wondering if the housing market's going to crash. There are a lot of questions and not a lot of answers.
So I'm really good at asking the question. I'm really bad about giving the answer. You remember when we were at, was it Best Ever back in February? And the theme of the conference was Survive Till 25.
We're starting to feel why now.
So. We are. But it's not all gloom and doom. There's some exciting stuff that we're going to talk about today in our episode about, is the Midwest due for big gains or is it not our time to shine? So why don't you introduce our guest today?
So with us today, we have Chad. And Chad, I missed the whole thing where we were figuring out how to pronounce your last name, and I promise I don't want to butcher it. So Chad, go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us where you're coming from.
Yep. Thanks a lot, Seth. Chad Sheeler from Fishers, Indiana, Midwest guy here.
Awesome. So not too far away from us. So we're in Lima, Ohio. And so Midwest is a great market. So, I mean, that's what we're going to talk about. Today we're going to dive into why maybe the Midwest might be poised for some new investors, for some increased gains, maybe over some of the more popular markets. I mean, I think over the last 3 to 4 years, everyone's just been Sunbelt, you know, talking about Texas, talking about West and East Coast. And a lot of times we kind of get lost in the muddle or we're just kind of looked over. But I think with some of the changes that we're seeing in the market today, that could change. I don't know. I'm going to dangle the carrot there. That could change.
And Chad, just to give some context for our listeners, you're in Indiana, but give us a little bit about a snapshot about what you're doing now. What's your kind of involvement in the real estate scene and multifamily? And then let's just jump in at the beginning, and that'll segue into our topic for today. How'd you get started in real estate?
Yep. 2-3 minute snapshot is after spending about 17 years in electronic payments industry, doing pretty well at that, decided to get into real estate after 3 years of overanalyzing books and podcasts and a lot of properties. So bought a fourplex about 3 years ago, made a ton of mistakes in that deal, bought a 15 unit, 20 unit, kind of went from there. Formed Focus Capital, my company, about 9 months ago, and left, now I'm full-time in the business today, building a team right now. We have a team of four, about to be probably six by end of the year. We acquired multifamily, and I'm an LP as well across the country.
So you started, and you were an LP prior to even getting into the active part of buying the fourplex, right?
Yep.
So how did you get, sometimes syndication, not so much anymore, but 5 years ago, it was kind of like this underground network of private real estate investment opportunities that people weren't aware were even out there. So what was your touch point with the concept of syndication and large multifamily acquisition?
I think it's still that way, Garrett. I think that we think it's normal because we're in this whole zone. You know, we see on LinkedIn and we're already tuned into it. All of our networks started doing this stuff.
So the algorithm knows that we're interested.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you go shop for a pair of socks and before you know it, every other post on Instagram, a pair of socks, right? God, they know that. But no, I think it's still not a widely known program. Well, I thought the investors, probably 30% of them don't even know about this opportunity and they have to understand it and don't get it. And we're there to educate them. But the reason why I chose to get started as an LP was really a buddy of mine was doing some development deals out in Arizona. And I had some extra cash and wanted to get into real estate. And I thought, you know what? Let's start as an limited partner on a deal. Let's kind of see how the whole thing works, get our feet wet that way before I go the active route. And I actually encourage my investors to do that as well, is do something that takes none of your time today. Right. Just be an LP. Right. And you can learn the ropes. You can see how they do the deals, how they structure their presentations. And that was my first taste. And then I cashed out on one of the deals a couple of years later and made a nice return and did a couple more of those. And then I went active on my own.
And just real quick, maybe for people that are listening that have not heard some of our other podcasts on syndications, give like a 1,000-foot overview. What's a syndication? And you know, what's an LP? What's a GP?
Yeah. 1,000-foot view. Honestly, syndication is a fancy word for a group investing deal. Like you're going to group investors together. So like people like, you know, a GP is general partnership. So general partnership is the operating group, the people who find the deal, they run the deal, they operate it, they manage it, and they do the whole nine yards, all the work, right? That's a GP. An LP is a limited partner. That's you just invest money, basically a silent investor. They're passive. They don't make any decisions. They put no time in the deal, no risk besides their capital. And they're the ones that bring the money in. And what we do is, as syndicators, we pair up the GP team and the LP team, the investors, the syndicator group, you know, they're bringing most of the capital and they get a nice return on their money, cash flows, appreciation, and they have a big upside.
Awesome.
So you guys, Focus Capital, has really doubled down on Midwest markets, Indiana, kind of proper. And let's get into that today. So, what are the conversations you're having and what are you hearing from other investors about the Midwest and how people expect it to perform kind of in these uncertain economic conditions?
Yeah. It's funny is we get investors that call and we talked on the phone, that previously had invested in those big markets like, you know, Arizona, Texas and Florida and, you know, West Coast. And they're looking at the Midwest as like a more stable market right now. Now, what helps is that we've been in the news. Well, it's Indianapolis is number one in the nation in rent growth right now, which is kind of cool. And other smaller cities in Indiana have been in the Wall Street Journal, as a matter of fact, like Lafayette, Indiana, my hometown. And we're getting some spotlight here. And you know, the Midwest is just one of those markets where it's not going to be super super high rent growth like last year. We didn't have 20% rent growth. Right. But we're also not seeing the rent growth retraction, the rent retraction that other markets are seeing right now either. We're just a very stable market. Got great schools, great places to work, great place to live a family, low cost of living. We've got still inventory issues, which everyone does right now. We still need more units to be built here. People can't still afford a first-time home here like they can everywhere else. Same thing. So people are more renters nowadays. Cost to own is higher than cost to rent. You know how that goes. And I think it's a great market. A lot of big companies are coming here. A lot of electric vehicle battery companies are coming here to build their plants. True. We've got, mattress companies, we've got chip companies coming here. We've got, a big pharma company, Eli Lilly, building a huge expansion, multi-billion dollar expansion in one of the markets that we invest in right now currently. Just bringing a lot of stuff here to the market.
I think you hit on a number of really key factors that are all working in tangent together. So you have that East Coast, West Coast, even the Southeast. There's a lot of factors as to why those markets are changing, right? A, they're more volatile, and that means appreciation and depreciation, right? Insurance is becoming a huge topic. The cost to insure properties and insurance companies changing their strategy about where they'll insure and how they'll insure properties. And a lot of that's being affected in some of these areas we're talking about. So when people look at their real estate holdings, and not even on a big level, you don't have to be in control of thousands of units and multifamily and big commercial properties to know that you want to diversify your risk in the real estate market. So, you know, we have a lot of people in Ohio that invest in Florida. And I think it's interesting that they invest in both places because Ohio, Lima proper, Northwest Ohio is a very cash flow driven real estate market, and Florida is more of that appreciation gain, you know, area. So as people are highly exposed in these metros and these markets around the country that are more volatile, to your point, Chad, the Midwest offers some stability that's much needed right now in people's real estate holdings. You couple that with the big manufacturing boom. You know, there's some reshoring that's happening. There's government money that's trying to push some different energy, you know, crisis solutions. And the Midwest has the infrastructure to facilitate job creation and placement of that capital from these companies. So I'd love to hear some of the specific, you had alluded to the chip factory. I know Intel in Columbus is a big one. P&G south on Cincinnati just continues to expand. I was just driving this morning past some, hundreds of thousands of square footage of manufacturing and distribution warehousing that's going up. And that seems to be everywhere throughout the Midwest right now. So I guess my question here too is, is it going to stop? Is there an end in sight? Do you think people will kind of pull back from the Midwest once things stabilize on the East and West Coast? Or is this here, is there some runway here for people to get some good returns in our area?
I think it's still going to continue. I just keep thinking about just the cost to own and the cost to rent and how this is a great place to live. Like, okay, yeah. Take myself, for example. Like, I could live anywhere I wanted to in the world right now, but I'm choosing to raise my family here. I'm paying a third of the amount of money to live here than California. I'm an outdoors kind of a guy. I love doing surfing and hiking, and I probably should live out in California or Colorado, honestly. But I want to live where it's cheap to live and then have money to travel where I want to go. And right, I think people resonate with that. People are more transient. And I mean, I think this market here is going to keep on growing. There's a lot of land here to still be built on. So these other plants come in here and build their facilities. There's acreage to buy up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can keep going on here, but I keep going back to just, it's a great place. I think investors, once they get a taste of the Midwest, how it's a more stable market and it's not as volatile, I think they're going to stay here with these deals. And let's be honest, like most people do these real estate deals because real estate on the whole spectrum of real estate invest on other investment opportunities on a risk adjusted return scale, real estate is usually the lowest of that. It's the lowest risk, you know, highest return. Right. Well, when you're in markets that have this huge volatility, that's a stock market. Why would you want to go in something that's very volatile? You get in the real estate right. To have something stable, right? Some reliable cash flow. So I think Midwest is best, personally.
So let's talk about some specific statistics. Seth and I were sitting in a session last week. By the time this drops, it's been about a month ago. And there was a CBRE guy giving a presentation about quarter two data of 2023. And specifically commercial real estate, but multifamily, you know, in specific. And so I want to rattle off a couple of these statistics and then I'd love to talk about it. So number one, this was shocking to me. I didn't realize how much of a gap has been created between mortgage costs to like the national average of a mortgage cost versus rental cost. Okay. So man, yeah. the average mortgage in the United States right now is $3,281. Okay. And the gap that is created or the delta from that to the average rent is $1,100 a month. And it wasn't 2 years ago that they were pretty much on par with each other on a graph where you could go and get a mortgage for what it would cost for rent. And there was a big boom of ownership. Well, then interest rates doubled in less than a year. And now that delta, that difference for someone to jump into home ownership is $1,100 a month. You throw in the fact that you're going to have to start paying student loans back again. And it's a tough time for sure to jump into home ownership. But if you're owning apartments or rentals, there's a big argument to be made that that model is here to stay.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't help but look at this. I posted a graph on LinkedIn a few weeks ago or a couple weeks ago about just how it compared every year from like 1970 to now of how the gap's been between cost to rent and cost to own. Mm-hmm. It's the highest gap now than ever before in the last 50 years. It's the highest. So you only have to wonder, okay, what's going to happen now when all these people can't go buy a house? Now we have a origination, they're forced to rent. Okay. Two things are going to happen. Either one is you're going to have just insane occupancy, which is great for us, right?
Right.
Or rents go up. They keep going up.
Yep. And so you mentioned on the occupancy, there was another graph that they had put up, and I don't have this in front of me. I just kind of did the notes from it. But it was surveying, you know, 20 markets, and it compared the average vacancy rate from 2012 to 2019. And, Atlanta, San Francisco, big markets. And then it had Midwest markets in there as well. And currently, as of this second quarter of 23, our vacancy is lower than the historical average of 2012 to 2019. And it's hovering around that 4 to 5% vacancy still, which is incredible, you know, and that's not showing signs of letting up. And this is just another one. I think this gets thrown around a lot is we're still 3.1 million housing units short nationally of where we need to be. And that gap is definitely closed, but it's going to be a slow grind to get to where we need to be.
And here's something else too on that note, sorry to interrupt you here, but I saw in a report a few weeks ago that 2024, we've got 50% fewer starts scheduled for new construction.
Yeah.
So that means we're going to be farther behind on these units to be built, which means even more demand for rentals.
For existing stock.
That's right. It's hard to imagine how much, I mean, 3 million units, it's hard to imagine how long it would take to really actually close that gap to decrease demand. Right. I mean, I, you know what I mean? It would take years and years of just some consistent building. And with interest rates going higher, I mean, obviously that hurts builders. And with the inflation that we've seen in the last couple of years, you know, everyone saw lumber go crazy. I know that's come down a little bit. But I mean, costs are not coming back down to where they were. I mean, it doesn't matter how much if they try to slow inflation. It doesn't mean costs are coming down. It means they are slowing to rise. So it's only getting harder and harder and harder for these people to make the numbers work without seeing increased rent growth to do some build to rent stuff. And you know,
and I want to make the connection for our listeners too. So like Chad had mentioned earlier, you know, he had done a lot of analyzing and we're going to talk about how to make a calculated risk, right? It's not just real estate's a great thing. I should go buy a house and rent it out, because that's such an oversimplified strategy that you'll get burnt doing that. But there are some very concrete things that you can do, and multifamily, residential, single, you know, renting is a great model right now because it gets you into real estate. It's a stable asset class to be in. So if you've been thinking about getting in, whether it's on an LP side of things where you're putting your capital to work and trusting someone else as an operator, or you want to go buy a duplex, a fourplex, a small multifamily, there is a good argument to be made that there's going to be a lot of money made still in this sector of real estate. But I don't want to overhype things. And that's what I think... we've seen in the past, Chad, is the YouTube course that comes out, right? And it overpromises and it gives you a 30-day solution to get out of the financial pinch or situation you feel stuck in. We know life doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And then you're on your parents' couch in 9 months and you're like, I wonder if I should file a class action lawsuit against that guy because this is bad advice. And I'm about 50 grand lighter than I need to be. But so I do want to kind of show both sides of the coin, right? And this might be a kind of an interesting question for us to answer. What are the limitations or the areas of exposure that may be more of a reality for a place like the Midwest? I just want to talk about that even as a group here to show just, hey, when you're making a decision, it's not just all upside, right? You know, the salesman always is going to tell you, hey, this is a good thing you jump in now, but you got to know what the possibility of risk is or what the present, you know, existence of risk is.
Yeah. So I think what your question is really like, how are we analyzing risk and managing risk right now in our deals?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, we do really heavy underwriting in all of our deals. Every deal we look at, put it through a big model, like 20 tabs, and just, we have a good analyst on our team full time. And, you know, we look at everything from, we look at all the comps in the area to what we think we can get market rent on these properties. And we actually back that down a little bit. We don't take the comps and what they are. We, you know, talk to the assessor's office for tax assessments and see what our tax are going to be in, you know, years, you know, year 2 to 5, year 1 to 5. We look at vacancy. We look at expense rates. We look at insurance, which is, oh, don't even start on that. That one's terrible right now. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. And again, that's why Midwest is better. We aren't seeing the premium jumps like other markets are too. Sidebar there. But I think you've got to really assess your risk from, okay, what's the operational risk on the deal? Like, who's managing it? That's number one. Is there a risk there? Is there a risk with the construction cost overruns? So if you're doing a lot of CapEx or renovations, like you have risk there. I mean, the bigger budget you've got, the largest risk you've got to go over budget. If you have a budget of $100,000 versus $1 million, you've got a lot more risk on a $1 million budget, right?
A 10% variance in that is very different outcome.
Yeah. And what's your risk on the exit? So what's your exit plan? Have you modeled in the proper cap rate multiple? Is, you know, it's multiple how you're valuing the property. Have you modeled the right expansion over the years to be conservative on your exit plan? What's your strategy there? If you're on assumable debt or maybe, God forbid, a bridge debt product, you know, what's your risk on interest rate risk? So that's the main areas.
Let's squeak back to you guys analyzing rent growth. in your future deals. And let's say, you know, someone's, you know, going to get a quadplex or maybe something a little more manageable for their first deal or second deal or whatever. And they're trying to figure out rent growth. So you talked about looking at other properties and checking out rent comparables, but you said you guys haven't even been really taking that for face value. And can you talk about why?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a prime example. We have a deal right now we're doing. We'll close on in about 30 days. And the comps in the area for a two-bed apartment were $1,153 on three of the comps, actually. So it's really, really good comps.
Yeah.
Similar vintage, similar size. The highest rents right now the property's getting is $950 a month for a two-bed. And we modeled in $1,025 on our investor presentation. And the reason why is, you know, that's one of, aside from the cap rate, that's probably the second biggest lever you can pull to manipulate returns and to see a big profit increase.
Right.
And I'm like, you know what, if we can just get great returns for our investors, you know, at a good IRR and dumb these numbers down, like we can just like crush this thing and we can just like give them a you know, a 3X return instead of a 2X return. Like,
right.
And maybe it won't make our numbers look as good, but I'd rather be conservative and show people that we can, you know, have me surprised in a good way than be surprised they're getting lower returns.
Well, and to your point, right, rent comparables are a snapshot of what is happening in the market today. And your pro forma, your business plan is stretching out over 3 to 5 years. And so it you have to take that into consideration of you're looking at what rents are doing today, and then you're building a plan off of it that is going to have to be able executable for the next 5 years. And so you're trying to consider that as well. And, you know, the other thing too, is you're tapped into local data of like, hey, Indianapolis was rated for the highest rent growth. And you're looking at what that projection is. But I think investors, and correct me if I'm wrong, do you have a lot of investors that are like, these returns are too low, we think you should be more aggressive right now?
Yeah. And I agree, man. So my point there is we got to educate people really on what levers people can pull or manipulate to inflate returns. You've got cap rate, you've got rent growth percentages year over year, you've got your average rents. And then finally, you've got your, your refi built in or not. That's a big one too. So you've got to educate people, and you can't be distracted by these shiny presentations, or you can't compare return versus return. You can't say, okay, this group has a 14 IRR, they've got a 20, I'm going with the 20. There's way more to it than that.
Yeah, that's true. And they have that return until they don't. You know what I mean? Because things
performance is just like a proposed presentation. Is no one really knows what's going to happen. We're just using our best educated, not guesses, but best analysis, trying to mitigate risk wherever we can. And that's how we get these assumptions.
I would probably go as far to say no one's ever hit their pro forma. It's probably either a little better or a little worse.
Never exact.
You know what I mean? No. So it's short-sighted just to look at some of those percentages or the, you know, the IRR, or, you know, the internal rate of return and, or the, cash on cash return and make your decision based on that.
So listen to this. This is kind of in the same vein, but, one of the graphs that we saw, they evaluated the top 20 markets in looking specifically at like 2-year projected rent growth. Okay. And you had mentioned Indianapolis was on that. Absolutely. And so here's the other players in the Midwest that were on the top 20 markets in the nation.
It's our time.
For rent growth. Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Columbus, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Kansas City, Louisville, and St. Louis, right? And that's the top 20 markets. And so I just think it's good for people to hear that. And so we were following Bigger Pockets when I first started in real estate like 5 years ago. And that they always love, those articles are super just, they're sexy. They grab people's attention, like top underrated markets, right? But it's cool to look at that. And I think there was a disconnect for how my strategy should adopt that information and how do I be actionable based on that? Okay. That's kind of, there's a gap between hearing data and figuring out how to apply it to your business. And so first of all is to understand that if rent growth is happening in some of these major metros around you, that's going to help you. So if Indianapolis is having a banner just run right now of rent growth, A, there's a reason why, and B, it's trickling out into those outlier communities like Lafayette that might not be a tier one market, but they're going to be able to benefit from that subsidiary growth, right? So use one of your deals, and let's just use it as a case study, okay? And for the next 5 minutes, I just want to break down those the factors that we've been talking about in theory and how you've seen them play out for one of your more recent deals.
Yeah, let's do that. So you want to go over one of the ones we've done in Indiana, like just for demographics and
Got it. So what was maybe your pro forma when you acquired it? What were some of those market rate rents you're now getting? Did those outpace or were those on par with what you thought? And just kind of all those assumptions.
Yeah. So this is a deal I bought a couple of years ago in Columbus, Indiana, 20 unit deal. And it was one that my third deal that I did. And it was one we found, I actually got outbid the first round. It's like, I was kind of bummed about, I missed it. And, you know, I've actually got almost half my deals now from being second in line. I don't mind it now, you know, hang around the hoop, they say.
Nice.
So let me pause right there. That's really interesting. Yeah. Okay. Because essentially what's happening is somebody's outbidding you, right? You came in and you stuck to your guns on what you thought you could get it bought for. You weren't the guy that won. And are you saying that the person that was quote unquote first in line, the deal fell apart before it got to the closing table with them? And then they come to you and the tone is different though, right? When they approach you and say, hey, are you still interested? And now it puts you in the seat of negotiating, like, well, maybe I am, maybe I'm not.
Well, this has happened two times now to where when it comes back to me, now it's a lower price. I've got it both times. Yeah. So not to say it'll happen every time, but anyway.
Are you saying it was lower than what your original bid was?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yep. That's awesome.
They did it for you. Great.
Yep. Yep. I think that that other buyer now is thinking themselves is on the market right now. We're selling it this week.
Nice.
You should text good case study. Actual real one coming here pretty soon, but I won't give you the whole hour version here. But basically, yeah, we got it for $50,000 less than we originally had offered on it. They came back to us and said, yep, let's go ahead and do it. So we bought that. And I loved that deal because I had learned my lessons on the first two deals on what not to do. So I made my corrections along the way on this deal. So by the third deal, I figured out, oh, I got to do better due diligence. Got to get a better inspection. Buy it from an owner that's well maintained very well. Buy in an area that's going to be strong for tenants to want to live there, quiet areas, you know, ones that will attract a good tenant type, not the kind that want to spend $500 a month on rent. And just wanted to have a good gap. So anyways, we bought this deal. Average rents were probably $680 a month. And I had reformed it out to get $1,025 a month in rents, which is a big jump. That's like $350 rent plus add water and sewer. Wow. And my plan was to go in there and spend like $15,000 a unit, which hindsight, I'm glad I didn't do that. But listen, my plan is to spend $15,000 a unit, all 20 units, renovate the whole thing, new LVP, fixtures, paint, whole nine yards, and add a laundry closet. There's no laundry on site at all, no hookups, nothing. So they can't do laundry. And I thought that, well, they want laundry, I must got to give it to them.
Right.
So we acquired the property, and the first three people that, we got to back up a second. So the reason why the first buyer backed out was when they did due diligence, they realized the seller had put all the lease end dates at 12/31. So everyone ended on 12/31.
No, in the winter.
So for our listeners, like that's really bad. Like your risk, talk about risk. Your
especially risk in the Midwest.
All move out on New Year's Day and you've got an empty property for the whole year. Or for at least a month.
Yeah.
So I saw that and I'm like, that's why I got a discount. And I thought, you know what? It'll be more work for us to kind of stagger leases and get people staggered to where they won't all end of the year. And it took us some work, but we got it done. And I'm glad I did that. So fast forwarding now to now we've acquired it. It was awesome maintained property, like no deferred maintenance. The roofs were awesome, like no foundation issues. I mean, it was smooth sailing. Fix up some landscaping outside, new signage, new paint, sidewalk repair, new mailboxes, you know, the whole nine yards outside. Mm-hmm. But for inside, we did the first three units and I thought, all right, we'll spend the $15,000. We'll do the whole nine yards. Did that. Mm-hmm. And we got $1,200 a month in rent.
Wow.
$107 more than I thought we would.
Wow. Yeah.
So then I thought, you know what? Let's just do the next two without the laundry and see what happens. Just kind of test the market here and see what we can do. As a laundry closet, it was like $6,000 by itself.
Yeah.
We had to build it out, plumb it out, add the dryer vent, drainage, circuit, everything, man. It was a lot of work. And did that, we got the exact same rent.
Holy cow. For 30% less than what your budget, you know, I mean, you took 30% off of your unit turns.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So then we went a step further and we were doing a few more units after that. And we're like, you know what? Let's just kind of skip the whole LVP on the whole main level and just do it in the kitchen, in the bathroom. Let's just leave carpet in there if it's good, right? We'll address it later if we need to. I mean, now we're down to like an average turn cost of like $5,000 a door, maybe $6,000, almost a third of what we thought it'd be. And we're getting the same rents.
Wow.
So we're actually selling it right now. We did 12 of the units. We turned those. We have 8 left. And people ask me, like, why would you get rid of your best property that you love? Like, why would you get rid of one that's cash flowing thousands per month, net cash flow? Mm-hmm. Why would you do this? Like, and there's two reasons. Number one, you learn about strategy when you're doing this business, and you can't just like max out the NOI and then go to sell it. It doesn't work that way. You've got to have some meat on the bone. There's got to be, you've got to have a value proposition for the next buyer to want to buy it. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have a big pool to cash your net out to people that want to buy a turnkey property or value add, you've got to have a property that will paint a good picture. And if we were to keep doing this business plan and hold it for 5 years, that's great. But for me, it's more velocity of capital to put in bigger deals and also to have a case study for our investors. A lot of investors want to see a full cycle deal. So that's why we're doing it.
Yeah.
What I love about that is that the deal worked, and even though you had your work cut out for you, you went ahead and jumped in with the rent assumptions being, you know, $1,025 a month. And I think this is just kind of the cool thing about real estate. You just never know. Yep. You just never know what's going to happen. And if you don't step in, you know what I mean? You would have missed out on all that extra upside. Because, I mean, anybody that looked at that deal and projected $1,200 a month, I mean, they would have paid a lot more for it and you would have got the deal. You know what I mean? So I think that's just one of the cool things about real estate is that you are rewarded when you move forward. Now, doesn't mean you're not going to make mistakes and lose money sometimes, but I think in a general sense, you got to move forward if you want to capitalize or capture any of the rewards that real estate has to offer.
I'll tell you something else too, is if I had followed the 1% rule, I wouldn't have bought this deal. I wouldn't have. It didn't follow the rule. It was like the 0.9% rule, honestly.
Right.
But I bought it because I felt really good about the market. I knew the location was so good that it would give me a good tailwind behind me to make the deal work. And that's what gave me a big bonus.
And that, I think that right there illustrates the principle of being an expert in your market. Okay. Because somebody who was sitting in their office, maybe in, you know, California or Texas, saw that pop up on LoopNet, you know, or deals like that. And they probably needed to use the 1% rule because their knowledge was limited on that area and what was going to happen. The reasons you felt confident about where the market was heading, they didn't have that. And so sometimes we look at ourselves and we're like, well, how do we invest out of state? How do we get into the markets where all the money's being made? Well, first of all, this episode is saying that it's coming to you because you live in the Midwest. But secondly, one of your biggest niches and advantages over anybody else is your local expertise and knowledge of the area. So just to give people encouragement that way. But
we're going to jump into our smaller pockets segment here. So Chad, go ahead and tell us about your worst deal. What happened? What went wrong? And then what did you learn from it?
I just want to say this is one of my favorite show segments. And it's really, it sounds sick, but everybody loves like a bad story, you know, when you're sitting around the campfire and you're just like, I'm going to one up you on
you are sick.
for what it's worth.
I mean, worst real estate deals. I'll tell you some mistakes I made, but I don't think there's any such thing as the worst deal. I think any deal, if it's a bad deal, it's a great learning lesson. It's a great seminar, right? You learn from that.
Yeah.
So whether I lose money or break even or make some money, it's a huge learning lesson. I've already learned from it already. It's along the way. So I'm trying to think of my first deal, my second deal. I think my second deal is probably a better one to give. So I bought a 15 unit deal. It's my second deal. Tertiary market near in the Indiana here, little submarket. And mistakes we made was we bought it from an off-market seller. I think all the units were like month to month, no leases at all, like no financials. We honestly went just by verbal trust in this guy, which hindsight never should have done. There was deferred maintenance. I can't even begin to tell you how much deferred maintenance we uncovered.
And there was no agent involved in that deal, right?
What was that?
There was no agent involved in that deal.
No, my buddy was who kind of mentoring me at the time. He found it through his network. So he kind of was the broker.
Gotcha.
But we made some mistakes. You know, we didn't review the inspection report properly. We missed a lot of stuff. We missed like sagging floors and like mold. We missed just so much stuff that cost us probably 150 grand extra, maybe 200 Ooh. Grand on our CapEx budget. It was insane, dude.
On a 15 unit.
It's bad.
It's not like you're talking about a 50 unit where you got to spend an extra 150 grand. You're talking a 15 unit, which is already a smaller, you know, deal, right?
I mean, I can't even begin to tell you. I mean, main sewer line issues. We had to like redo some structural issues. We had sagging floor joists, like tenants could have fallen through the floor. We had like cracking. I mean, it was just insane. We had to gut a few of the apartments out. We had mold behind one of the walls. We had, we had roof issues. We had things weren't wired correctly. Like some of the water heaters were wired to other people's apartments. So they weren't paying like their own water heaters or paying somebody else's bills. And it was a mess, dude. I spent so many hours in that property managing the process. So aside from going way over budget on the CapEx.
So do you remember what your original budget was?
I think it was like 180 grand. Yeah. 180 grand was so the CapEx.
You almost doubled.
So, and real quick, while we're going through this, because it's all relevant, and the goal here is not to laugh at Chad's misery, guys, for all you sick people out there, the goal is to learn from this. So you had alluded to the fact that you didn't review the inspection reports properly. So you got the right inspections done on the property, right? But just maybe having somebody there who knew what to look for, or you were just so rosy-eyed on getting the deal done, or what was that?
You know, the partner of mine that found the deal, you know, he was in the deal for 20%. I was 80% because he helped me find it, wanted to stay in the deal with some money too. And I mean, he's got a lot of skills. But between the two of us, I take ownership alongside him. I mean, it was our deal together. We just didn't review it enough. Like I'm not an in the weeds kind of a guy, and I've realized that's not my strength.
Yeah.
And neither is he. Like we just didn't have another person to review it thoroughly. Yeah. And we just
It's okay that's not your strength. You just lacked that team member then, that full team who's gonna blow the whistle and okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So had we known that, we would have been back to the seller and either like cancel the contract or retraded. So that's a lesson right there is if we had done that, we could have some ammo to go back and buy the property for the value it truly was. That's the lesson there.
Gotcha.
So how'd that deal turn out?
Well, there's more to the story, but go ahead. I mean, we had to fire our contractor. We lost like $40,000. We basically funded him too much money. You've heard all the stories, right? You've heard this before. Like you give them advance payment and then they don't do all the work and they want some more money to finish more of the work, but they're really robbing Peter to pay Paul. Well, we were Peter. They robbed us. Before you know it, we've got like 300 should have finished and they haven't started at all. We've already gave them like $40,000 and they walked off basically. Man. And we're like, holy cow, this sucks. And we're like, do we sue? Do we not? We just had to suck it up, man. Just go find somebody else, redo a bunch of stuff they had messed up. So 40 grand there. So now we're up to like 240 or 220 that we've lost so far in this deal, right? They're over budget.
So you finally finished the deal, right? Did you finish it? Did you just end up selling it? Did you just walk away from it?
We're selling it right now, actually. It's for sale. Okay. We've got a couple of buyers that we're countering today. I think we'll still get about a 15% return overall in the project. Maybe 14. It should have been like a 35, though.
Like, would you buy this?
Way higher. Oh, something else, too, is I learned that you got to review your loan docs. So what we thought was a 4% fixed interest deal out of the gate was actually a variable interest rate deal until you went to a permanent loan, which happens after you finish your CapEx.
During the construction portion of it, it was variable.
Exactly. Which some lenders will fix it out of the gate, which I require that on these deals, but this one did not. And I'm like, wow. I'm busy with the CapEx stuff, the construction, and I'm getting these invoices in the mail with from the lender about notification of my mortgage payment. I'm like, all right, whatever, you know, file away. And about a year into this, maybe 8 months into this, I'm like, why is our rate like 5.5%? Or no, I was like, why is it 4.75%? Why is it almost 5%? And I called the lender and they're like, well, you fix it once it goes permanent. And I'm like, when can that happen? They're like, when you finish with the construction. I'm like, well, we have like a year left. They're like, okay, well, that's what it is. So I'm like, wow. I feel like I'm screwed here. So this kept going on. And it's at 6% now from 4%. And we had modeled 4% in our underwriting. Mm. And I'm like, this is crazy. So I called the lender up. I'm like, look, I'm just going to fix it right now. Go ahead and do permanent debt right now on the property. Let's fix it. So we basically had to pay interest on the unused construction funds, but we fixed the rate from going any further on the property. But man, lesson learned. I mean, we had 50% higher debt costs because of that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Long story short, yeah, we'll have a decent return. Honestly, man, if we just break even, I'm just happy to get out of the deal and go to the next one. Been a huge learning experience.
What year did you buy that?
2021.
Okay. So things were already in an upswing there, but the market carried you along even further. So that's awesome. I'm glad it looks like you're going to maybe make a little bit or break even. That is a crazy story. That's quite the nightmare.
I didn't think it was going to be that bad.
No, we had to fire a PM company too in the whole middle of it. We had to fire a PM company. We had a lot of challenges there.
Right before this comes up, we're going to be like, viewer discretion, you know, not advised, you know, disclaimer, you
an
know.
Age requirement.
This is why you do a passive investment, not an active investment. <I'm just
kidding. laughs> Well, your hair looks like not gray and still full. So, you handle the stress well. We talk about how there is a grit component to investing in real estate that you have to have. And it's a muscle that only gets strong by like working it out. And if everything's easy, you're not ready for the hard times, which are bound to come. So, hey, let's transition here into what we call our little nugget. So, Chad, this is a practical takeaway, a piece of advice, something that you lean on or that you can impart to our listeners that they can apply to their businesses.
You know, Garrett, I was going to talk about, markets and locations, man. But you know what? I think it's more of a, I'm going to give a piece of advice that I've learned last year that's really helped me personally in business. I think it's going to apply to more people. And I think it's, for me, it's like making decisions faster than overanalyzing things. And this is going to apply to people doing passive real estate or active real estate. And like my thinking now is like, how quickly can I make a mistake and then learn from that? I'd rather make a decision now, whether it's a right or wrong decision, and learn from that, right? Like they say, it's the best decision is a decision, and the worst is no decision at all. Yeah. And now I look back, like what did I fail at recently? Because that shows that I'm growing and you're growing. And like these deals that I've done, like I've made so many mistakes, but if I hadn't done those, then I wouldn't be doing bigger deals now. I wouldn't learn along the way. So you've got to make the mistakes. You can't be afraid to get out there and just have grit, roll your sleeves up, right? And just get dirty and get it done, because you have to make those learning lessons along the way. And I think the one lesson there for me is I spent 3 years reading books and podcasts, and no amount of learning can prepare you for the real world. It can't. You have to just get there and do it.
Right. You know, to comment on that, I think at least for me, the fear that I struggle with about failure is that it's going to be met with so much criticism from other people. And that'll definitely happen. But here's what I didn't anticipate. Anybody else who's trying to make moves and trying to get out there and be decisive, they're kind of those fellow guys in the boat, quote unquote, with you. And I've just received unexpected support from people who see, hey, you are trying to grow and that's going to happen. So the people who are actively trying to do what you're going to do are going to understand and expect failure to happen.
And usually they've already had some failure themselves.
Right.
And so it's understandable. And not that it's excusable, but I mean, we all need to learn from it. But I think there's a lot more grace to spread around because we've all been there.
I'll point our listeners, if you're listening to this, there's a poem that Teddy Roosevelt did, and it's a very common quote poem, and I've got it up in my living room because I love it, and it's called The Man in the Arena. And it starts out by saying, it's not the critic who counts, right? And opinions are plentiful, you know, nowadays. They're everywhere.
Everyone has
social media. Everybody's got them. But it's not the critic who counts. It's the person who's in the arena trying to make it happen. And so I think it's great advice, man, for people who maybe are in that stuck spot. By doing nothing, you are deciding to do something. So, hey, let's pivot to kind of our last part of our show here. I want to start by just giving you an opportunity to say, what's been the greatest resource in your real estate investing career?
The greatest resource, I can't tell you this one. I think it can be split between a person and maybe an actual resource, like educational resource. Having a mentor is a game changer for me, man. Paying to a coach program, having one of those is huge learning, huge way to boost my learning and get more confidence and shave years off my learning curve. So I recommend doing that or finding something to partner with. But resource, I just think learning from people that have already done it is the best resource. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of like online resources, but I think it's just people that have done it and like learning from them is the best resource.
Isn't it amazing that we live in the quote unquote digital age, the information era? And what you said has been a response that a lot of our guests have given, that it's still about people and specifically that personal interaction, mm-hmm. right? Not just reading an article, because that's information coming from somebody, but you cannot remove the relational component that we will always depend on.
Yep.
So I think that's great.
Yep. I agree.
Talk about Focus Capital, what you guys are doing, and then how some of our listeners could follow your guys' success.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Focus Capital, you know, we're Midwest, you know, company, like I said, and you know, we're basically finding some new deals here. We're on a growth path right now. We're, you know, about 200 doors right now under management and going to be at 1,000 at some point. You know, I don't know when that'll be, but we'll see. And we're building a team. So right now we're focused on our foundations, right? We're focused on our foundations. We've got some great people in place. We're adding two more people by probably the end of the year. And we're going to be prepared for next year because this is all opportunity coming, guys. Like if you're a buyer in this space, you're going to just get ready. There's a big wave coming. And we see that. So we'll be ready for that. So we're busy growing our investor network. We're looking at looking for people that want to passively invest in our projects, looking for partners to help, you know, co-partner with us to bring us deals or bring us capital. We can be reached out on LinkedIn. I'm on there all the time, every day, usually. Chad Sheeler, and then also you can email me at chad@focusedcapital.com.
Great. We'll put awesome. That stuff in the show notes. And then you guys have a website too, focusedcapital.com. We'll put that there. So awesome, man. Hey, thank you. We're always excited to link arms with a fellow Midwest compatriot and excited to see what's going to happen in our neck of the woods, man.
That's awesome, guys. Great. Awesome.
As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.